Frey is marshalling his levies at the Twins.
No matter, Lord Tywin said. Frey only takes the field when the scent of victory is in the air, and all he smells now is ruin. And Jason Malasa lacks the strength to fight alone. Once Jamie takes River Run, they will both be quick enough to bend the knee. Unless the Starks and the Aerons come forth to oppose us, this war is good as won.
I would not fret overmuch about the Aerons, if I were you, Tyrion said. The Starks are another matter. Lord Eddard
is our hostage,
his father said.
He will lead no armies while he rots in a dungeon under the Red Keep.
No, Sir Kevin agreed.
But his son has called the banners and sits at Moat Cailin with a strong host around him.
No sword is strong until it's been tempered, Lord Tywin declared. The Stark boy is a child. No doubt he likes the sound of war horns well enough and the sight of his banners fluttering in the wind. But in the end, it comes down to butcher's work. I doubt he has the stomach for it.
Things had gotten interesting while he'd been away, Tyrion reflected. And what is our fearless monarch doing whilst all this butcher's work is being done? He wondered. How has my lovely and persuasive sister gotten Robert to agree to the imprisonment of his dear friend Ned? Robert Baratheon is dead, his father told him. Your nephew reigns in King's Landing. That did take Tyrion aback. My sister, you mean? He took another gulp of ale. The realm would be a much different place with Cersei ruling in place of her husband.
If you have a mind to make yourself of use, I will give you a command, his father said. Mark Piper and Carol Vance are loose in our rear, raiding our lands across the Red Fork.
Tyrion made a tisking sound. The gall of them fighting back. Ordinarily, I'd be glad to punish such rudeness, father, but the truth is, I have pressing business elsewhere.
Do you?
Lord Tywin did not seem awed.
We also have a pair of Ned Stark's afterthoughts, making a nuisance of themselves by harassing my foraging parties. Beric Dondarrion, some young lordling with delusions of valour. He has that fat jape of a priest with him, the one who likes to set his sword on fire. Do you think you might be able to deal with them as you scamper off without making too much of a botch of it?
Tyrion wiped his mouth with the back of his hand and smiled. Father, it warms my heart to think that you might entrust me with, what, 20 men? 50? Are you sure you can spare so many? Well, no matter. If I come across Thoros and Lord Beric, I shall spank them both.
He climbed down from his chair and waddled to the sideboard, where a wheel of veined white cheese sat surrounded by fruit.
First, though, I have some promises of my own to keep, he said as he sliced off a wedge. I shall require 3,000 helms and as many hauberks, plus swords, pikes, steel spearheads, maces, battle axes, gauntlets, gorgets, greaves, breastplates, wagons to carry all this.
The door behind him opened with a crash, so violently that Tyrion almost dropped his cheese. Sir Kevin leapt up swearing as the captain of the guard went flying across the room to smash against the hearth. As he tumbled down into the cold ashes, his lion helm askew, Shagger snapped the man's sword in two over a knee thick as a tree trunk, threw down the pieces, and lumbered into the common room. He was preceded by his stench, riper than the cheese and overpowering in that closed space.
Little red cape, he snarled. When next you bear steel on Shagger, son of Dolph,
I will chop off your manhood and roast it in the fire.
What, no goats? Tyrion said, taking a bite of cheese. The other clansmen followed Shagger into the common room, Bronn with them. The sellsword gave Tyrion a rueful shrug.
Who made you be?
Lord Tywin asked, cool as snow.
They followed me home, father, Tyrion explained. May I keep them? They don't eat much.
No one was smiling. By what right do you savages intrude in our councils? Demanded Sir Kevin.
Savages? Lowlander?
Cun might have been handsome if you washed him.
We are free men, and free men, by rights, sit on all war councils.
Which one is the landlord? Chella asked.
They are both old men, announced Timot, son of Timot, who had yet to see his 20th year. Sir Kevin's hand went to his sword hilt, but his brother placed two fingers on his wrist and held him fast. Lord Tywin seemed unperturbed.
Tyrion, have you forgotten your courtesies? Kindly acquaint us with our honored guests.
Tyrion licked his fingers.
With pleasure, he said. The fair maid is Chella, daughter of Cheek of the Black Years. I'm no maid, Chella protested. My sons have taken 50 ears among them.
May they take 50 more?
Tyrion waddled away from her.
This is Conn, son of Carat. Shagar, son of Dolph, is the one who looks like Castle Rock with hair. They are stone crows. Here is Ulf, son of Umar of the Moon Brothers. Here is Timet, son of Timet, a red hand of the Burn Men. And this is Bronn, a sellsword of no particular allegiance. He has already changed sides twice in the short time I've known him. Yeah, you and he ought to get on famously, father.
To Bronn and the clansmen, he said,
May I present my lord father, Tywin, son of Tytos, of House Lannister, lord of Casterly Rock, warden of the West, shield of Lannisport, and once and future and of the king.
Lord Tywin rose, dignified and correct.
Even in the West, we know the prowess of the warrior clans of the Mountains of the Moon. What brings you down from your strongholds, my lords?
Horses, said Shagger. A promise of silk and steel, said Timot, son of Timot.
Tyrion was about to tell his lord father how he proposed to reduce the Vale of Arryn to a smoking wasteland, but he was never given the chance. The door banged open again. The messenger gave Tyrion's clansman a quick, queer look as he dropped to one knee before Lord Tywin.
My lord, he said, Sir Adam bid me tell you that the Stark Host is moving down the causeway.
Lord Tywin Lannister did not smile. Lord Tywin never smiled. But Tyrion had learned to read his father's pleasure all the same, and it was there on his face.
So the wolfling is leaving his den to play among the lions, he said in a voice of quiet satisfaction. Splendid! Return to Sir Adam and tell him to fall back. He is not to engage the northerners until we arrive, but I want him to harass their flanks and draw them farther south.
It will be as you command,
the rider took his leave.
We are well situated here, Sir Kevin pointed out, close to the ford and ringed by pits and spikes. If they are coming south, I say let them come and break themselves against us.
The boy may hang back or lose his courage when he sees our numbers, Lord Tywin replied. The sooner the Starks are broken, the sooner I shall be free to deal with Stannis Baratheon. Tell the drummers to beat assembly and send word to Jaime that I am marching against Robb Stark.
As you will, Sir Kevin said. Tyrion watched with a grim fascination as his lord father turned next to the half-wild clansmen.
It is said that the men of the mountain clans are warriors without fear.
It is said truly,
Conn of the Stone Crows answered.
And the women,
Chella added.
Ride with me against my enemies, and you shall have all my son promised you, and more,
Lord Tywin told them.
Would you pay us with our own coin?
Ulf, son of Umar, said.
Why should we need the father's promise when we have the son's?
I said nothing of need,
Lord Tywin replied.
My words were courtesy, nothing more. You need not join us. The men of the Winterlands are made of iron and ice, and even my boldest knights fear to face them.
Oh, deftly done,
Tyrion thought, smiling crookedly.
The Burn Men fear nothing. Timit, son of Timit, will ride with the lions.
Wherever the Burn Men go, the Stone Crows have been there first, Conn declared hotly. We ride as well. Shagger, son of Dolph, will chop off their manhoods and feed them to the crows.
We will ride with you, landlord,
Chella, daughter of Cheek, agreed.
But only if your half-man son goes with us. He has bought his breath with promises. Until we hold the steel he has pledged us, his life is ours.
Lord Tywin turned his gold-flecked eyes on his son.
Joy,
Tyrion said with a resigned smile. Daenerys. Meereen was as large as Astabor and Yunkai combined. Like her sister cities, she was built of brick. But where Astabor had been red and Yunkai yellow, Meereen was made with bricks of many colours. Her walls were higher than Yunkai's and in better repair, studded with bastions and anchored by great defensive towers at every angle. Behind them, huge against the sky, could be seen the top of the Great Pyramid, a monstrous thing 800 feet tall with a towering bronze harpy at its top.
The harpy is a craven thing,
Dario Naharis said when he saw it.
She has a woman's heart and a chicken's legs. Small wonder her sons hide behind their walls.
But the hero did not hide. He rode out the city gates, armored in scales of copper and jet, and mounted upon a white charger, whose striped pink and white barding matched the silk cloak flowing from the hero's shoulders. The lance he bore was 14 feet long, swirled in pink and white, and his hair was shaped and teased and lacquered into two great curling ram's horns. Back and forth he rode beneath the walls of multicolored bricks, challenging the besiegers to send a champion forth to meet him in single combat. Her blood riders were in such a fever to go meet him that they almost came to blows. Blood of my blood, Danny told them, your place is here by me. This man is a buzzing fly, no more. Ignore him. He will soon be gone. Aego, Jogo, and Ricaro were brave warriors, but they were young and too valuable to risk. They kept her Khalasar together and were her best scouts, too.
That was wisely done, Sir Jorah said, as they watched from the front of her pavilion. Let the fool ride back and forth and shout until his horse goes lame. He does us no harm.
He does, Arston Whitebeard insisted. Wars are not won with swords and spears alone, sir. Two hosts of equal strength may come together, but one will break and run, whilst the other stands. This hero builds courage in the hearts of his own men, and plants the seeds of doubt in ours.
Sir Jorah snorted. And if our champion were to lose, what sort of seed would that plant?
A man who fears battle wins no victory, sir.
But not speaking of battle, Meereen's gates will not open if that fool falls. Why risk a life for naught?
For honour, I would say.
I've heard enough,
Danny did not need their squabbling on top of all the other troubles that plagued her. Marine posed dangers far more serious than one pink and white hero shouting insults, and she could not let herself be distracted. Her host numbered more than 80,000 after Yunkai, but fewer than a quarter of them were soldiers. The rest, well, Sir Jorah called them mouths with feet, and soon they would be starving. The great masters of Marine had withdrawn before Danny's advance, harvesting all they could and burning what they could not harvest. Scorched fields and poison wells had greeted her at every hand. Worst of all, they had nailed a slave child up on every milepost along the coast road from Yunkai. Nailed them up, still living, with their entrails hanging out, and one arm always outstretched to point the way to Marine. Leading her van, Dario had given orders for the children to be taken down before Danny had to see them. But she had countermanded him as soon as she was told. "I will see them," she said. "I will see everyone and count them and look upon their faces. And I will remember." By the time they came to Marine, sitting on the salt coast beside her river, the count stood at 163. "I will have this city," Danny pledged to herself once more. The pink and white hero taunted the besiegers for an hour, mocking their manhood, mothers, wives, and gods. Marine's defenders cheered him on from the city walls. "His name is Uznak Zopal," Bran Ben Plum told her when he arrived for the war council. He was the new commander of the Second Sons, chosen by a vote of his fellow sellswords. "I was bodyguard to his uncle once, before I joined the Second Sons, the Great Masters. What a ripe lot of maggots. The women weren't so bad. That was worth your life to look at the wrong one the wrong way. I knew a man, Scarb. This Uznak cut his liver out. Claimed to be defending a lady's honour, he did. Said Scarb had raped her with his eyes. How'd you rape a wench with eyes, I ask you? But his uncle is the richest man in Marine, and his father commands the city guard, so I had to run like a rat before he killed me too." They watched Uznak Zopal dismount his white charger, undo his robes, pull out his manhood, and direct a stream of urine in the general direction of the olive grove, where Danny's gold pavilion stood amongst the burnt trees. He was still pissing when Dario Naharis rode up, arrack in hand.
"Shall I cut that off for you, eh? And stuff it down his mouth, your grace."
His gold tooth shone amidst the blue of his forked beard. "It's his city I want, not his meagre manhood." She was growing angry, however. "If I ignore this any longer, my own people will think me weak." Yet who could she send? She needed Dario as much as she did her blood riders. Without the flamboyant Tairoshi, she had no hold on the Stormcrows, many of whom had been followers of Prendelnar Gazin and Salor the Bald. High on the walls of Marine, the jeers had grown louder, and now hundreds of the defenders were taking their lead from the hero and pissing down through the ramparts to show their contempt for the besiegers. "They are pissing on slaves, to show how little they fear us," she thought. "They would never dare such a thing if it were a Dothraki Khalasar outside their gates."
"This challenge must be met," Arsten said again.
"It will be," Danny said, as the hero tucked his penis away again. "Tell Strong Belwas I have need of him." They found the huge brown eunuch sitting in the shade of her pavilion, eating a sausage. He finished it in three bites, wiped his greasy hands clean on his trousers, and sent Arsten Whitebeard to fetch him his steel. The aged squire honed Belwas's arrack every evening and rubbed it down with bright red oil. When Whitebeard brought the sword, Strong Belwas squinted down the edge, grunted, slid the blade back into its leather sheath, and tied the sword belt about his vast waist. Arsten had brought his shield as well, a round steel disc no larger than a pie plate, which the eunuch grasped with his offhand rather than strapping to his forearm in the manner of Westeros.
"Fine liver and onions, Whitebeard," Belwas said.
Not for now, for after. Killing makes Strong Belwas hungry.
He did not wait for a reply, but lumbered from the olive grove toward Osnag Zopal.
Why that one, Khaleesi? Recaro demanded of her. He is fat and stupid.
Strong Belwas was a slave here in the fighting pits. If this highborn Osnak should fall to such, the great masters will be shamed. While if he wins, well, it's a poor victory for one so noble, one that Marine can take no pride in. And unlike Ser Jorah, Dario, Bron Ben, and her three blood riders, the eunuch did not lead troops, plan battles, or give her counsel. He does nothing but eat and boast and bellow at Arstan. Belwas was a man she could most easily spare, and it was time she learned what sort of protector Magister Illyrio had sent her. A thrum of excitement went through the siege lines when Belwas was seen plodding toward the city, and from the walls and towers of Marine came shouts and jeers. Osnag Zopal mounted up again and waited, his striped lance held upright. The charger tossed his head impatiently and pawed the sandy earth. As massive as he was, the eunuch looked small beside the hero and his horse.
"A chivalrous man would dismount," said Austin.
Osnag Zopal lowered his lance and charged. Belwas stopped, with legs spread wide. In one hand was a small round shield, in the other the curved arrack that Austin tended with such care. His great bronze stomach and sagging chest were bare above the yellow silk sash knotted about his waist, and he wore no armor but his studded leather vest, so absurdly small that it did not even cover his nipples. "We should have given him chainmail," Danny said, suddenly anxious.
"Mail would only slow him," said Ser Jorah. "They wear no armor in the fighting pits. It's blood the crowds come to see."
Dust flew from the hooves of the white charger. Osnak thundered towards Strong Belwas, his striped cloak streaming from his shoulders. The whole city of Marine seemed to be screaming him on. The besiegers' cheers seemed few and thin by comparison. Her unsullied stood in silent ranks, watching with stone faces. Belwas might have been made of stone as well. He stood in the horse's path, his vest stretched tight across his broad back. Osnak's lance was levelled at the centre of his chest. Its bright steel point winked in the sunlight. "He's going to be impaled," she thought, as the eunuch spun sideways, and quick as the blink of an eye, the horseman was beyond him, wheeling, raising the lance. Belwas made no move to strike at him. The Miranese on the wall screamed even louder.
"What is he doing?" Danny demanded.
"Giving the mob a show," Ser Jorah said.
Osnak brought the horse around Belwas in a wide circle, then dug in with his spurs and charged again. Again Belwas waited, then spun and knocked the point of the lance aside. She could hear the eunuch's booming laughter echoing across the plain as the hero went past him.
"The lance is too long," Ser Jorah said. "All Belwas needs do is avoid the point. Instead of trying to spit him so prettily, the fool should ride right over him."
Osnag Zopal charged a third time, and now Danny could see plainly that he was riding past Belwas, the way a Westerosi knight might ride at an opponent in a tilt rather than at him, like a Dothraki riding down a foe. The flat level ground allowed the charger to get up a good speed, but it also made it easy for the eunuch to dodge the cumbersome 14-foot lance. Marine's pink and white hero tried to anticipate this time, and swung his lance sideways at the last second, to catch Strong Belwas when he dodged, but the eunuch had anticipated too, and this time he dropped down instead of spinning sideways. The lance passed harmlessly over his head, and suddenly Belwas was rolling and bringing the razor-sharp arrack around in a silver arc. They heard the charger scream as the blade bit into his legs, and then the horse was falling, the hero tumbling from the saddle. A sudden silence swept along the brick parapets of Marine. Now it was Danny's people who were screaming and cheering. Osnak leapt clear of his horse and managed to draw his sword before Strong Belwas was on him. Steel sang against steel, too fast and furious for Danny to follow the blows. It could not have been a dozen heartbeats before Belwas's chest was awash in blood from a slice below his breast, and Osnak Zopal had an arrack planted right between his ram's horns. The eunuch wrenched the blade loose and parted the hero's head from his body with three savage blows to the neck. He held it up high for the Marinese to see, then flung it toward the city gates and let it bounce and roll across the sand.
"So much for the hero of Marine," said Dario, laughing.
"A victory without meaning," Sir Jorah cautioned. "We will not win Marine by killing its defenders one at a time."
"No," Danny agreed, "but I'm pleased we killed this one." The defenders on the walls began firing their crossbows at Belwas, but the bolts fell short or skittered harmlessly along the ground. The eunuch turned his back on the steel-tipped rein, lowered his trousers, squatted, and shat in the direction of the city. He wiped himself with Osnak's striped cloak and paused long enough to loot the hero's corpse and put the dying horse out of its agony before trudging back to the olive grove. The besiegers gave him a raucous welcome as soon as he reached the camp. A Dothraki hooted and screamed, and the Unsullied sent up a great clangor by banging their spears against their shields.
"Well done," Sir Jorah told him,
and Bran Ben tossed the eunuch a ripe plum and said, "A sweet fruit for a sweet fight." Even her Dothraki handmaids had words of praise.
"We would braid your hair and hang a bell in it, Strong Belwas," said Jiqui, "but you have no hair to braid."
"Strong Belwas needs no tinkly bells."
The eunuch ate Bran Ben's plum in four big bites and tossed aside the stone.
"Strong Belwas needs liver and onions."
"You shall have it," said Danny. "Strong Belwas is hurt." His stomach was red with the blood sheeting down from the meaty gash beneath his breasts.
"It is nothing. I let each man cut me once before I kill him."
He slapped his bloody belly.
"Count the cuts, and you will know how many Strong Belwas has slain."
But Danny had lost Khal Drogo to a similar wound, and she was not willing to let it go untreated. She sent Missandei to find a certain Yunkish freedman renowned for his skill in the healing arts. Belwas howled and complained, but Danny scolded him and called him a big, bald baby until he let the healer staunch the wound with vinegar, sew it shut, and bind his chest with strips of linen soaked in fire wine. Only then did she lead her captains and commanders inside her pavilion for their council. "I must have this city," she told them, sitting cross-legged on a pile of cushions, her dragons all about her. Irian Jiqui poured wine. "Her granaries are full to bursting. There are figs and dates and olives growing on the terraces of her pyramids, and casks of salt fish and smoked meat buried in her cellars."
"And fat chests of gold, silver, and gemstones as well," Dario reminded them. "Let us not forget the gemstones."
"I've had a look at the landward walls, and I see no point of weakness," said Sir Jorah Mormont. "Given time, we might be able to mine beneath a tower and make a breach, but what do we eat while we're digging? Our stores are all but exhausted."
"No weakness in the landward walls," said Danny. Marine stood on a jut of sand and stone, where the slow brown Skahazadan flowed into Slaver's Bay. The city's north wall ran along the riverbank, its west along the bay shore. "Does that mean we might attack from the river or the sea?"
"With three ships, we'll want to have Captain Grolio take a good look at the wall along the river, but unless it's crumbling, that's just a wetter way to die."
"What if we were to build siege towers? My brother Viserys told tales of such. I know they can be made."
"From Ward, Your Grace," Sir Jorah said, "the slavers have burnt every tree within 20 leagues of here. Without wood, we have no trebuchets to smash the walls. No ladders to go over them. No siege towers, no turtles, and no rams. We can storm the gates with axes, to be sure, but...
Did you see them bronze heads above the gates? Asked Bran Ben Plum. Rows of harpy heads with open mouths. The Meronese can squirt boiling oil out of their mouths and cook your axemen where they stand.
Dario Naharis gave Grey Worm a smile.
Perhaps the Unsullied should wield their axes. Boiling oil feels like no more than a warm bath to you, I have heard.
This is false.
Grey Worm did not return the smile.
These ones do not feel burns as men do, yet such oil blinds and kills. The Unsullied do not fear to die, though. Give these ones rams, and we will batter down these gates or die in the attempt.
You would die, said Brown Ben. At Yunkai, when he took command of the Second Sons, he claimed to be the veteran of 100 battles. Though I will not say I fought bravely in all of them. There are old sellswords and bold sellswords, but no old bold sellswords.
She saw that it was true. Danny sighed. I will not throw away Unsullied lives, Grey Worm. Perhaps we can starve the city out. Sir Jorah looked unhappy.
We'll starve long before they do, Your Grace. There's no food here, no fodder for our mules and horses. I do not like this river water either. Marine shits into the Skahazadan, but draws its drinking water from deep wells. Already we've had reports of sickness in the camps, fever and brown leg, and 3 cases of the bloody flux. There will be more if we remain. The slaves are weak from the march.
Freedmen, Danny corrected. They are slaves no longer.
Slave or free, they are hungry and they'll soon be sick. The city is better provisioned than we are, and can be resupplied by water. Your 3 ships are not enough to deny them access to both the river and the sea.
Then what do you advise, Sir Jorah?
You will not like it.
I would hear it all the same.
As you wish. I say, let this city be. You cannot free every slave in the world, Khaleesi. Your war is in Westeros.
I have not forgotten Westeros. Danny dreamt of it some nights, this fabled land that she had never seen. If I let Marine's old brick walls defeat me so easily, though, how will I ever take the great stone castles of Westeros?
As Aegon did, Sir Jorah said, with fire. By the time we reach the 7 kingdoms, your dragons will be grown, and we will have siege towers and trebuchets as well, all the things we lack here. But the way across the lands of the long summer is long and grueling, and there are dangers we cannot know. You stopped at Astapor to buy an army, not to start a war. Save your spears and swords for the 7 kingdoms, my queen. Leave Marine to the Meronese and march west for Pentos.
Defeated, said Danny, bristling.
When cowards hide behind great walls, it is they who are defeated, Khaleesi, Kojogo said.
Her other blood riders concurred.
Blood of my blood, said Ricardo. When cowards hide and burn the food and fodder, great carls must seek for braver foes. This is known. It is known, Jiqui agreed as she poured.
Not to me. Danny set great store by Sir Jorah's council, but to leave Marine untouched was more than she could stomach. She could not forget the children on their posts, the birds tearing at their entrails, their skinny arms pointing up the coast road. Sir Jorah, you say we have no food left. If I march west, how can I feed my freedmen?
You cannot. I'm sorry, Khaleesi. They must feed themselves or starve. Many and more will die along the march, yes. That will be hard, but there is no way to save them. We need to put this scorched earth well behind us.
Danny had left a trail of corpses behind her when she crossed the Red Waste. It was a sight she never meant to see again. No, she said, I will not march my people off to die. My children, there must be some way into this city.
I know a way.
Bran Ben Plum stroked his speckled grey and white beard.
Sewers.
Sewers? What do you mean?
Great brick sewers empty into the Skahazadan, carrying the city's waste. They might be a way in, for a few. That was how I escaped, Marine, after Skarb lost his head.
Bronben made a face.
The smell has never left me. I dream of it some nights.
Sir Jorah looked dubious.
Easier to go out than in, it would seem to me. These sewers empty into the river, you say. That would mean the mouths are right below the walls.
And closed with iron grates, Bronben admitted. Though some have rusted through, else I would have drowned in shit. Once inside, it's a long, foul climb in pitch dark through a maze of brick where a man could lose himself forever. The filth is never lower than waist high and can rise above your head from the stains I saw on the walls. There's things down there, too, biggest rats you ever saw. And worse things, nasty.
Dario Naharis laughed.
As nasty as you, when you came crying out, eh? If any man were fool enough to try this, every slaver and marine would smell them the moment they emerged.
Bronben shrugged. Ergrays asked if there was a way in, so I told her. But Ben Plum isn't going down in them sores again, not for all the gold in the Seven Kingdoms. If there's others want to try it, though, they're welcome.
Ego, Jogo, and Grey Worm all tried to speak at once, but Danny raised her hand for silence. These sores do not sound promising. Grey Worm would lead his Unsullied down the sores if she commanded it, she knew. Her blood riders would do no less, but none of them were suited to the task. The Dothraki were horsemen, and the strength of the Unsullied was their discipline on the battlefield. Can I send men to die in the dark on such a slender hope?
I must think on this some more. Return to your duties.
Her captains bowed and left her with her handmaids and her dragons. But as Brown Ben was leaving, Viserion spread his pale white wings and flapped lazily at his head. One of the wings buffeted the cell sword in his face. The white dragon landed awkwardly with one foot on the man's head and one on his shoulder, shrieked, and flew off again.
He likes you, Ben, said Danny. And well he might, Brown Ben laughed. I have me a drop of the dragon blood myself, you know.
You?
Danny was startled. Plum was a creature of the Free Companies, an amiable mongrel. He had a broad brown face with a broken nose and a head of nappy grey hair, and his Dothraki mother had bequeathed him large brown almond-shaped eyes. He claimed to be part Bravasi, part Summon Islander, part Ibanese, part Kohorik, part Dothraki, part Dornish, and part Westerosi, but this was the first she had heard of Targaryen blood. She gave him a searching look and said, How could that be?
Well, said Brown Ben, there was some old plum in the Sunset Kingdoms who wed a dragon princess. My grandmama told me the tale. He lived in King Aegon's day.
Which King Aegon? Danny asked. Five Aegons have ruled in Westeros. Her brother's son would have been the sixth, but the usurper's men had dashed his head against a wall.
Five, were there? Well, that's a confusion. I could not give you a number, my queen. This old plum was a lord, though. Must have been a famous fellow in his day, the talk of all the land. The thing was, begging your royal pardon, he had himself a cock, 6 foot long.
The three bells in Danny's braid tinkled when she laughed.
You mean inches, I think. Feet,
Brown Ben said firmly.
If it was inches, who'd want to talk about it now?
Your Grace.
Danny giggled like a little girl.
Did your grandmother claim she'd actually seen this prodigy? That the old crone never did. She was half Ibanese and half Kohorik. Never been to Westeros. My grandfather must have told her. Some Dothraki killed him before I was born.
And where did your grandfather's knowledge come from?
One of them tales told at the tit, I'd guess.
Bron Ben shrugged.
That's all I know about Aegon the Unnumbered or old Lord Plum's mighty manhood, I fear. I'd best see to my sons.
Go do that, Danny told him. When Bron Ben left, She lay back on her cushions. "If you were grown," she told Drogon, scratching him between the horns, "I'd fly you over the walls and melt that harpy down to slag. But it would be years before her dragons were large enough to ride. And when they are, who shall ride them? The dragon has three heads, but I have only one." She thought of Dario. If ever there was a man who could rape a woman with his eyes. To be sure, she was just as guilty. Danny found herself stealing looks at the Tyroshi when her captains came to council, and sometimes at night she remembered the way his gold tooth glittered when he smiled. That, and his eyes, his bright blue eyes. On the road from Yunkai, Dario had brought her a flower or a sprig of some plant every evening when he made his report, to help her learn the land, he said. Wasp willow, dusky roses, wild mint, lady's lace, dagger leaf, broom, prickly ben, harpy's gold. He tried to spare me the sight of the dead children, too. He should not have done that, but he meant it kindly. And Dario Naharis made her laugh, which Ser Jorah never did. Danny tried to imagine what it would be like if she allowed Dario to kiss her, the way Jorah had kissed her on the ship. The thought was exciting and disturbing both at once. It's too great a risk. The Tyroshi sellsword was not a good man. No one needed to tell her that. Under the smiles and jests, he was dangerous, even cruel. Selor and Prendal had woken one morning as his partners. That very night, he'd given her their heads. Khal Drogo could be cruel as well, and there was never a man more dangerous. She had come to love him all the same. Could I love Dario? What would it mean if I took him into my bed? Would that make him one of the heads of the dragon? Ser Jorah would be angry, she knew, but he was the one who said she had to take two husbands. Perhaps I should marry them both and be done with it. But these were foolish thoughts. She had a city to take, and dreaming of kisses and some sellsword's bright blue eyes would not help her breach the walls of Meereen. "I am the blood of the dragon," Danny reminded herself. Her thoughts were spinning in circles like a rat chasing its tail. Suddenly she could not stand the close confines of the pavilion another moment. "I want to feel the wind on my face and smell the sea." "Missandei," she called. "Have my silver saddled, your own mount as well." The little scribe bowed.
"As your grace commands, shall I summon your bloodliners to guard you?"
"We'll take Arstan. I do not mean to leave the camps." She had no enemies among her children, and the old squire would not talk too much, as Belwas would, or look at her like Dario. The grove of burnt olive trees in which she raised her pavilion stood beside the sea, between the Dothraki camp and that of the Unsullied. When the horses had been saddled, Danny and her companions set out along the shoreline away from the city. Even so, she could feel Meereen at her back, mocking her. When she looked over one shoulder, there it stood, the afternoon sun blazing off the bronze harpy atop the Great Pyramid. Inside Meereen, the slavers would soon be reclining in their fringed tokars to feast on lamb and olives, unborn puppies, honeyed dormice, and other such delicacies, whilst outside her children went hungry. A sudden wild anger filled her. "I will bring you down," she swore. As they rode past the stakes and pits that surrounded the eunuch encampment, Danny could hear Grey Worm and his sergeants running one company through a series of drills with shield, short sword, and heavy spear. Another company was bathing in the sea, clad only in white linen breechclouts. The eunuchs were very clean, she had noticed. Some of her sellswords smelled as if they had not washed or changed their clothes since her father lost the Iron Throne, but the Unsullied bathed each evening, even if they'd marched all day. When no water was available, they cleansed themselves with sand, the Dothraki way. The eunuchs knelt as she passed, raising clenched fists to their breasts. Danny returned the salute. The tide was coming in, and the surf foamed about the feet of her silver. She could see her ship standing out to sea. Balerion floated nearest, the great cog once known as Sardulian, her sails furled. Further out were the galleys Meraxes and Vagar, formerly Jozo's Prank and Summer Sun. They were Magister Illyrio's ships, in truth, not hers at all, and yet she had given them new names with hardly a thought. Dragon names and more. In old Valyria before the Doom, Balerion, Meraxes, and Vagar had been gods. South of the ordered realm of stakes, pits, drills, and bathing eunuchs lay the encampments of her freedmen, a far noisier and more chaotic place. Danny had armed the former slaves as best she could with weapons from Astapor and Yunkai, and Ser Jorah had organized the fighting men into four strong companies, yet she saw no one drilling here. They passed a driftwood fire where 100 people had gathered to roast the carcass of a horse. She could smell the meat and hear the fat sizzling as the spit boys turned, but the sight only made her frown. Children ran behind their horses, skipping and laughing. Instead of salutes, voices called to her on every side in a babble of tongues. Some of the freedmen greeted her as mother, whilst others begged for boons or favours. Some prayed for strange gods to bless her, and some asked her to bless them instead. She smiled at them, turning right and left, touching their hands when they raised them, letting those who knelt reach up to touch her stirrup or her leg. Many of the freedmen believed there was good fortune in her touch. "If it helps give them courage, let them touch me," she thought. "There are hard trials yet ahead." Danny had stopped to speak to a pregnant woman who wanted the mother of dragons to name her baby, when someone reached up and grabbed her left wrist. Turning, she glimpsed a tall, ragged man with a shaved head and a sunburnt face. "Not so hard," she started to say, but before she could finish, he'd yanked her bodily from the saddle. The ground came up and knocked the breath out of her as her silver whinnied and backed away. Stunned, Danny rolled to her side and pushed herself onto one elbow. And then she saw the sword.
"There's that treacherous sow," he said. "I knew you'd come to get your feet kissed one day."
His head was bald as a melon, his nose red and peeling, but she knew that voice and those pale green eyes.
"I'm going to start by cutting off your tits."
Danny was dimly aware of Missandei shouting for help. A freedman edged forward, but only a step. One quick slash, and he was on his knees, blood running down his face. Miro wiped his sword on his breeches.
"Who's next?"
"I am."
Austin Whitebeard leapt from his horse and stood over her, the salt wind riffling through his snowy hair, both hands on his tall hardwood staff.
"Grandfather," Miro said, "run off before I break your stick in two and buggy you with—"
The old man fainted with one end of the staff, pulled it back, and whipped the other end about faster than Danny would have believed. The Titan's bastard staggered back into the surf, spitting blood and broken teeth from the ruin of his mouth. Whitebeard put Danny behind him. Miro slashed at his face. The old man jerked back, cat quick. The staff thumped Miro's ribs, sending him reeling. Austin splashed sideways, parried a looping cut, danced away from a second, checked a third mid-swing. The moves were so fast she could hardly follow. Missandei was pulling Danny to her feet when she heard a crack. She thought Austin's staff had snapped until she saw the jagged bone jutting from Miro's calf. As he fell, the Titan's bastard twisted and lunged, sending his point straight at the old man's chest. Whitebeard swept the blade aside almost contemptuously and smashed the other end of his staff against the big man's temple. Mero went sprawling, blood bubbling from his mouth as the waves washed over him. A moment later, the freedman washed over him too, knives and stones and angry fists rising and falling in a frenzy. Danny turned away, sickened. She was more frightened now than when it had been happening. He would have killed me.
"Your grace,"
Austin knelt.
I am an old man, and shamed. He should never have gotten close enough to seize you. I was lax. I did not know him without his beard and hair.
No more than I did. Danny took a deep breath to stop her shaking. Enemies everywhere. Take me back to my tent, please. By the time Mormont arrived, she was huddled in her lion's pelt, drinking a cup of spice wine. I had a look at the river wall, Sir Jorah started. It's a few feet higher than the others and just as strong, and the Myrnees have a dozen fire hulks tied up beneath the ramparts. She cut him off. You might have warned me that the Titan's bastard had escaped. He frowned.
I saw no need to frighten you, Your Grace. I have offered a reward for his head.
Pay it to Whitebeard. Murro has been with us all the way from Yunkai. He shaved his beard off and lost himself amongst the freedmen, waiting for a chance for vengeance. Arston killed him. Sir Jorah gave the old man a long look.
A squire with a stick slew Murro of Braavos? Is that the way of it?
A stick, Danny confirmed, but no longer a squire. Sir Jorah, it's my wish that Arston be knighted.
No.
The loud refusal was surprise enough. Stranger still, it came from both men at once. Sir Jorah drew his sword.
The Titan's bastard was a nasty piece of work and good at killing. Who are you, old man? A better knight than you, sir,
Arston said coldly.
Knight?
Danny was confused. You said you were a squire.
I was, Your Grace.
He dropped to one knee.
I squired for Lord Swan in my youth, and at Magistro Illyria's behest I have served Strong Belwas as well. But during the years between, I was a knight in Westeros. I have told you no lies, my queen, yet there are truths I have withheld, and for that, and all my other sins, I can only beg your forgiveness.
What truths have you withheld? Danny did not like this. You will tell me now. He bowed his head.
At Kaas, when you asked my name, I said I was called Arston. That much was true. Many men had called me by that name while Belros and I were making our way east to find you. But it's not my true name.
She was more confused than angry. He has played me false, just as Jorah warned me. Yet he saved my life just now. Sir Jorah flushed red.
Murro shaved his beard, but you grew one, didn't you? No wonder you look so bloody familiar.
You know him? Danny asked the exiled knight. Lost.
I saw him perhaps a dozen times. From afar, most often, standing with his brothers or riding in some tourney. But every man in the Seven Kingdoms knew Barristan the Bold.
He laid the point of his sword against the old man's neck.
Khaleesi, before you kneel, Sir Barristan Selmy, Lord Commander of the King's Guard, who betrayed your house to serve the usurper Robert Baratheon.
The old knight did not so much as blink.
The crow calls the raven black, and you speak of betrayal.
Why are you here? Danny demanded of him. If Robert sent you to kill me, why did you save my life? He served the usurper. He betrayed Rhaegar's memory and abandoned Viserys to live and die in exile. Yet if he wanted me dead, he need only have stood aside. I want the whole truth now, on your honour as a knight. Are you the usurper's man or mine?
Yours, if you will have me.
Sir Barristan had tears in his eyes.
I took Robert's pardon, aye. I served him in Kingsguard and Council. Served with the Kingslayer and others near as bad, who soiled the white cloak I wore. Nothing will excuse that. I might be serving in King's Landing still, if the vile boy upon the Iron Throne had not cast me aside. It shames me to admit. But when he took the cloak that the white bull had draped about my shoulders, and sent men to kill me that selfsame day, it was as though he dripped a caul off my eyes. That was when I knew I must find my true king and die in his service.
I can grant that wish, Sir Jorah said darkly. Quiet, said Danny. I'll hear him out.
It may be that I must die a traitor's death,
Sir Barristan said.
If so, I should not die alone. Before I took Robert's pardon, I fought against him on the Trident. You were on the other side of that battle, Mormont, were you not?
He did not wait for an answer.
Your Grace, I'm sorry I misled you. It was the only way to keep the Lannisters from learning that I had joined you. You are watched, as your brother was. Lord Varys reported every move Viserys made for years. Whilst I sat on the small council, I heard 100 such reports. And since the day you wed Khal Drogo, there has been an informer by your side, selling your secrets, trading whispers to the spider for gold and promises.
It cannot mean. You are mistaken. Danny looked at Jorah Mormont. Tell him he's mistaken. There's no informer, Sir Jorah. Tell him. We've crossed the Dothraki Sea together and the Red Waste. Her heart fluttered like a bird in a trap. Tell him, Jorah. Tell him how he got it wrong. The others take you, Selmy. Sir Jorah flung his long sword to the carpet.
Khaleesi, it was only at the start, before I came to know you, before I came to love. Do not say that word.
She backed away from him. How could you? What did the usurper promise you? Gold? Was it gold? The Undying had said she would be betrayed twice more, once for gold and once for love. Tell me what you were promised.
Varys said I might go home.
He bowed his head. I was going to take you home. Her dragon sensed her fury. Viserion roared, and smoke rose grey from his snout. Drogon beat the air with black wings, and Rhaegal twisted his head back and belched flame. I should say the word and burn the two of them. Was there no one she could trust? No one to keep her safe? Are all the knights of Westeros so false as you two? Get out, before my dragons roast you both. What does roast liar smell like? As foul as Bran Ben Sewers? Go! Sir Barristan rose stiff and slow. For the first time he looked his age.
Where shall we go, Your Grace?
To hell, to serve King Robert. Danny felt hot tears on her cheeks. Drogon screamed, lashing his tail back and forth. The others can have you both.
Go. Go away forever, both of you. The next time I see your faces, I'll have your traitors' heads off.
She could not say the words, though. They betrayed me, but they saved me. But they lied.
You go.
My bear, my fierce, strong bear. What will I do without him? And the old man, my brother's friend.
You go, go.
Where? And then she knew.
Sansa. They had been singing in the Sept all morning, since the first report of enemy sails had reached the castle. The sound of their voices mingled with the whicker of horses, the clank of steel, and the groaning hinges of the great bronze gates, to make a strange and fearful music. In the Sept, they sing for the mother's mercy, but on the walls, it's the warrior they pray to, and all in silence. She remembered how Septa Mordain used to tell them that the warrior and the mother were only two faces of the same great god. But if there's only one, whose prayers will be heard? Sir Meryn Trant held the blood bay for Joffrey to mount. Boy and horse alike wore gilded mail and enamel crimson plate, with matching golden lions on their heads. The pale sunlight flashed off the golds and reds every time Joff moved. Bright, shining, and empty, Sansa thought. The imp was mounted on a red stallion, armored more plainly than the king, in battle gear that made him look like a little boy dressed up in his father's clothes. but there was nothing childish about the battle-axe slung below his shield. Sir Mandan Moore rode at his side, white steel, icy bright.